I'm the Paula Hamilton Scholar and Professor for 2 years here at Finlandia. And my job is to work on Finnish North American literature. Right now I'm working to put together an anthology that includes what I think is, in some ways, the best and in some ways, the typical kind of to typify the kind of writing each author is doing. So when I'm going through and reading all of their works, what I'm trying to do is pick something that is really representative of what you would find and include that in the anthology. The works are starting from, I think, the earliest piece I have thus far was published in the 50s, and that's from Kimmo Pesäjä. He's primarily a science fiction writer, but we don't talk about him today. We'll talk about him maybe later in this academic year. And I talked about him in the last presentation. And then the most recent are things that are published even now in 2008. So it's quite a broad collection. It will include fiction, and some creative nonfiction, but more fiction than nonfiction, and poetry. And it seems that the Finnish Americans like most poetry, that they create more poetry than they do other things. And then the next, of course, is fiction. Well, fiction is belief, and the nonfiction is the most, but this is all autobiography. And so in some cases when the autobiography is particularly poetic or literary, I can include it. But for the most part, if it's designed to be historic, then I don't include it. But this, I have a tentative contract from Edwin Mellon that I promised I would deliver the manuscript by September of next year. And so if all permissions come in on time, we can expect a publication in January, something like that, 2010. So it's kind of exciting. And when I started out, I thought, well, maybe 300, 350 pages. And the more that I look and the more that I read and the more I reread and the more I scour my shelves, because all of this I buy and I think it's important that I do, I discover more and more incredible work that I just can't skip. And so on the one hand, I do a lot of writing about it and a lot of collecting it. And then on the other hand, I write my own creatively too. And I brought some, if people want to just glance after, during, whatever, some of the publications I've done. And then I also brought some of the publications I talk about today. One piece, I think, from every author. What I did not bring in today was the critical work, and I see that that was an oversight on my part, because I am actually drawing on other scholars' works when I get to this work. And this is still a work in progress. Let's go back to the title. Finnish North American Creative Writers on Finnishness. From simple identification to representation to glorification to transnational identification. Yeah, okay. And obviously that's designed for an academic journal. And it's in the works. I've given this presentation one time before, and that caused me to do a lot of revision and rethinking. I gave it at the University of Helsinki's annual meeting of the Finnish Society for the Study of English. And then, of course, my colleagues asked really deep and important questions, and so I had to think again. It, I think, has resulted in a better take on this. But I'm still working it out, because I'm stuck with the notion of third-generation writing, symbolic ethnicity, and then what I'm seeing happening in some fourth-generation writers that I didn't see before. So maybe you can help me with this. When I started out, this is a larger book project also that I'm working on. I'm doing two things. It's the collecting of the literature, sure, and then the other is writing about the literature. And so I've talked about, in the various of the Journal of Finnish Studies articles, I talked about various permutations of Finnish North American writing. Some of the articles are kind of really flawed, but it was my earliest thinking, and I wish that it didn't exist out there in the public, but it does. Although the more I work on this, the I guess the better sense I get of it. And here, if you're working on generational experiences of culture, and so in a sense, how do Finnish Americans represent their generational point of view? You can define generation, though, in more than one way. You can say, okay, I am the grandparent, there is the child, there's the grandchild, like this, but that's not quite how, in my context, about generation. I'm meaning the first generation immigrants, the offspring of that immigrant, and subsequent generations. So it's a different way of seeing. But we can see our cultural identity is you know, national, ethnic, linguistic, sexual, behavioral, self-definition, generation, social position, and you know where we what we do for our work. And this is a scheme that came from Siegert and Wiehoff, which should be on. We have an interesting problem here. In any case, this gave me the frame for the book. So what I'm envisioning in my critical edition, which will kind of accompany the anthology, is really chapters on sexual, behavioral, generational, the kind of ethnic, linguistic identities. I have some what I call the interlanguage texts, which are really interesting to look at, and they're one of the things I'd like to come up with next. It's not the only way of looking at this literature, but I come from a kind of more historic and from a cultural anthropology point of view rather than a literary point of view, so it kind of makes me oddly different. Given the fact that my education comes out of a little bit of cultural studies and a lot of kind of postmodern writing theory, it's not an unusual place for me to be talking from. Okay, so Peter Kivisto, Finnish American immigration scholar, and has a work called Attenuated Ethnicity, and I believe that's the one I'm quoting. He has several in here, anyway. But he draws on others in his field really to frame the way we think about this. And this is important. You see the first generation, so these are people who've come from Finland, either to Canada or to the U.S., depending on which of the Finnish North American authors we're talking about. They're in the process of disorganization and reorganization. In terms of their identity, they were Finns, now they're trying to be Americans, and it is a kind of an internal process. They wrote for their internally divided communities, so this isn't anything that's written for the public at large. So they're defining in their work Finnishness for themselves, for their children, for their friends. In these, they're actually not extended family structures because you have a person who probably has no grandparents or, and in many cases, no other relatives. So it's these communities that pull together in very tight families. Then you have the second generation who are in transition, and they link to dominant groups, social groups, in support of success. But this success is determined in kind of real American terms. So, like, for example, the first generation comes here, works really hard, sends their children to school. The first generation is primarily Finnish. The second generation is, their whole business is to become American, to be American, to experience what we think is the American dream, that success, that the second generation. And so what they're, my Uncle Chucky may walk in at any moment, and but I'm going to tell the truth. Okay, so when I said I was really studying Finnish North American literature, he looked at me incredulously, and he went, "Why?" But because he's a second generation, it's his job not to be Finnish, but to be American, and to be American in American terms. That means get the education, have the position, and that sort of thing. Someone's peeking at it. I'm in a little scale. Then there's the third generation. Of course, most of the authors that we're looking at are like my generation. We get mad because our parents, who said, really, why are you studying that? They kind of skipped us, and so we want to look back and say, no, what is this finishness? We have to discover what it is. And even before I did any of this studying, this was my orientation. I had to go back and find out whatever it was that's important. So it was kind of interesting to read Kivisto's work and discover that I am just enacting what could have been predicted by reading his work. I felt weird. I was like, are you spying on me? Okay. What happens here, and which has been asserted in many places, and this is where I'm having the problem, and you'll see when we get to looking at the examples, this business of symbolic ethnicity. Symbolic ethnicity is like we live American every day in and day out, but when it comes to a Finnish holiday, we get out our Finnish flag and wave it. We buy our Sisu cups and we have our little license plates on our cars that are Finnish flags. I disagree with symbolic ethnicity, but I can't prove it. Okay, so I look at it and I say, I think that there's something more substantive than can be explained by this notion of symbolic ethnicity. And we see it in the presentation. We'll see two different things happening. We'll get to it. Okay, and then the transnational. The transnationals, and this also is a term that I've just decided that I'm allowed to use, although I'm not using it necessarily in the way that some literary scholars would use it. They might suggest that a transnational is someone who lives in, say, the U.S. and spends a really significant amount of time in their country of origin. So it gives them a different perspective on that country of origin. It means that they actually have two homes, where they make their money and where they find their heart, something like that. But I think that we have at least one transnational in my slightly expanded definition, which requires less residence in the country of the culture of origin than traditional literary scholars might suggest. And so I'm still arguing this point, and you'll see. But you'll see what I get at when we get to it. The thing about transnationals is that they share in first-hand experience of the culture of origin. So in other words, these transnationals who are the, say, maybe fourth generation, maybe third generation authors, they have first-hand experience of Finland. They can carry on conversations with Finns when Finns are bilingual, or when they have some, still maintain some, or develop some fluency in Finnish. So we see that sort of there's a progress. Being immigrants, really, trying really strongly in the second generation to be American, the third generation being sad, trying to rediscover ethnicity, and then the transnationals who actually visit, and because of communication technology and travel technology, it's a whole lot easier to do than ever before. So you start being specific. So let's look at it. And that text is here, I think, is the Finnish Baker's Daughter. Catch up to see where I should be. In Kivisto's yeah, we're good there. Okay. A first generation immigrants to Canada included Ivy Gronlund Schneider, whose partially fictional work. And there's a lot of his autobiographies that are like that. You're not sure how strictly they observe the facts. And I think that for readability, it's nice maybe that they didn't always.
Grohlin Schneider addresses life in the immigrant community and draws comparisons between the country of origin and the host country. And of course, this is from the immigrant's point of view. At first, mostly in favor of the mores and norms of the culture of origin, but increasingly in favor of the host country. So you can watch a kind of an interesting thing happening there. These are just some quotes from the text. As a child, Grohlin Schneider was taken by her parents to Canada, and I think it's actually Timmins, Ontario, where that country singer is from. She traveled with her mother to join her father, who had already set up the family baking business. When you look at the text from chapter 3 to 11, it addresses comparisons between Finnish and Canadian life. And so this is something that's really important to the author, Schneider. Discussing issues such as jobs, food, clothing, family relations, home furnishings, national traits, and other issues, with the perspective of the narration told from a Finnish loyalty. So it's very strongly loyal to the Finnish, and the Finnish way is the right way. Not surprising, though, because that's sort of immigrant fiction. You're dislocated, you're uncomfortable in the new environment. As the three girls, who are the daughters in the story, grow into their middle and later teens, however, their loyalties begin to shift, and the comparisons between things Canadian and things Finnish begin to favor the Canadian, with the Finnish representing the old culture. For example, when shopping for a wedding ring for a woman fresh from Finland who was coming to Canada as a mail order bride, Eileen sees the new percolator. In our house, the Finnish coffee pots were still used, and I felt that the percolators were just about the smartest kitchenware I had seen. Her mother, however, had different ideas. The very idea of getting such a thing for a bride just out of Finland, of course she would not use it. Where was there a girl who did not leave Finland with her own coffee pot, with her own copper coffee pot? And besides, she had yet to taste coffee with a flavor as good as the kind that was made in a good copper pot where the ground actually boiled in the water. So, the division of loyalties is clear, with the younger woman favoring the Canadian innovations over the traditional Finnish ones, and the mother exhibiting loyalties in the reverse. But the other thing is, they may have at that time had percolators in Finland, but in the mother's experience, they didn't. But and Schneider, just being a representative or an example of a lot of these works that you can see, and there are many, many, many of them. And the autobiography can happen in the first, second, or third generation. It's just as common. It's not only first generation authors that are writing autobiography. But Grohlin Schneider uses repeated references to specifics. The cleanliness and orderliness of Finnish homes, obvious rightness of Finnish houses to build kitchen stoves into the construction rather than having them built as an appliance that you add on later. This is particularly a problem for the baker's family because they think that these newfangled ovens are just not as good as the ones that are built in. And given that they're bakers, it matters. Preference for Finnish coffee pots or utensils, and these are listed and named out. Preference for Finnish food, celebrations, dress, holidays, etc. I think they complain a lot about white bread.
As they should.
I know.
Should. The worst thing man invented.
I could stop making bread from brown berry if you mastered my recipe. Okay.
Go to Spice of Life. Get some good mountain green.
Okay. The significance of first generation preferences is clear. Finland is a specific place with specific people and events. Grandparents are in Finland. In the first generation writing, that's where they found their first love. These are kind of important things. Finland and North America are complex. They're not like them. They're shown as different. older immigrants prefer the old country as they see the mother preferring the old copper coffee pots and the younger generation preferring the percolators. And the younger ones are in process from preference for the old to the new. They don't always get there, but sometimes they do. So then the second generation view. And the emphasis is really on fostering economic and other success, whether that's educational or... but it's acquiring the accoutrements of Americanness and the American dream. And it's also where there was a beginning of understanding of America's streets aren't paved with gold. So there's also some discipline in this kind of writing. Paula, give us Robin. There's a typo in one book, and it put her name as Ivanska Robin. And when I saw it first, it was Ivanska, and that is wrong. And so I have actually spelled it wrong in a publication. But it was someone who knew her personally who corrected it. So this has gone out with the wrong spellings down. Anyway, her fictionalized history of the Little Rollstone Hill and Eileen Yarvinba's collection of essays in Two Cultures demonstrate the supports and limits of ethnic society in the host country. These, again, are two kind of typical works. And that's what... And that book is here too. But I think you can still buy it from North Star Press. Okay. Ivanska Robin's work begins in the early Finnish immigrant community of the Depression years. I know her siblings and her parents moved to Fitchburg, Massachusetts, where they stay with Aino's aunt Emily, Aino's mother's sister. Notice the Finnish name. The family uses what is left from selling their house in Bambere for a down payment for a boarding house where the mother works hard to make the payments and has enough left to clothe and feed the children. Aino's father looks for work but takes a long time to find anything, a longer time than they have money with which to sustain themselves. The father is a member of the Socialist Party, and the mother is intimately involved with the Finnish Saima Park organization, both sustained by and separated by Finnish institutions. Since the divisions in Finnish American society are deep, the interests of the parents in two different sectors of society serve to move them into separate spheres. The Saima Park group of religious Finns would support the temperance movement, while the socialist group would be more likely to drink the alcohol in spite of prohibition. So that's the setting. The economic struggles of the immigrant couple exacerbate the division already in the households, and the families put under terrible strain. Clearly, the cultural institutions erected to assist individuals in the host culture did not support these two individuals. The institutions did, however, maintain their sense of Finnishness as they sought to make their way in the new country. So what you see is the father suffering more and more from alcoholism in this story, and pretty much falling into demise. I'm trying to find a nice way to say that. It was very bad for him. It destroyed the family, and the mother, because she didn't spend she found social support for her success in the boarding house, and the religious institutions that supported her were very helped her in her success. But what happened was that then there was a divergence in the family in the story, and the father really does not do well.
What do you mean by excuse his early drinking?
The socialist, they supported.
I'm talking about the second
part. The over-involvement, the church separated Helmy from her husband, excused his early drinking, and rendered it alienated him. It was like you just put up with the guy because he's dysfunctional. It's sort of a, instead of taking it straight on, that's what's presented in the text. So that she's struggling with it. And
right, they both kind of enabling.
I think so. And it's, well, it's really dysfunctional. You should read the book. Yeah. It's like really heart wrenching because, and I'm not giving away the whole story. What happens is really sad in the end. It's kind of devastating. But in the second generation, you see institutions and really they're erected to help individuals to succeed in the American society. So that the socialists would be supporting kinds of ways to assert working people's rights in the political mainstream. The same, the religious groups are supporting a social kind of point of view, and that these families can come, grow, be successful here in the U.S. So in this case, it wasn't all that successful, and the one half. The religious part was successful, the socialist part wasn't successful. You can see, no matter which of these writings about, you know, set and dealing with temperance movements, socialism and all of that, you'll see more or less success. And it's not always one group or the other that's successful. It's just a variety. In this case, I just happened to pick this example because I think it's well written. But it typifies kind of the experience. People struggle, that brush of the America's streets paved with gold stuff is kind of wearing off. It's not an easy thing to make such a drastic cultural change. There are struggles within the text about people learning English, being successful in this new environment. So this Into Culture is a collection of work by Eileen Yagnaga, and I think at Ellis Island she lost her E. It would have been Yagnaga, or else it was changed later. But
she's a good author.
She is, and she has a couple of books of poetry. One I can't remember the names right off. But if you go to the website, you can find all of the references for all of the works. And you can find where to get them.
And it's interesting that her daughter carries this on in song and in writing.
Yeah. She has at least two books of poetry that I know of. Okay. This one is specifically, she is interviewing people and they're talking specifically about the second generation experience. And it's pretty, Viola Yevans Brown. Okay, so you can see that. I just gave you this one. For example, anyway, Viola Yevans Brown, for example, writes in the mixed language typical of that generation. And these, I think, are really fascinating. And it kind of represents the cultural information that they have. And all of you who speak Finnish, please pardon my pronunciation. I will try my best. Okay. We develop a Finglish of our own, she says. Kirjakaappi is a bookcase. Became Kirjokaappi. A coffee cup without a handle was a ribless cup. Rikotan, hukki. A sugar lump, pala, sukkaria. And that became pala, suk. If you read Hino half Tuotinen, Bullfight in the Sauna, Sauna Pukki, he also has a dictionary in which he explains this changing language. Vienna Kaki Larsen also notes the influence of the immigrant generation institutions in her life. Attached to the store was the Finn Hall, the center of all our social activities. There were basketball games, gym classes, drama clubs, and of course, Saturday night dances. Since many of us did not have many relatives in this country, Finnish friends became our extended families. what we can see though when you read these things that you see evidence of that struggle that immigrants undergo. But you also see organizations are based on Finnish ethnicity and promote individual well-being. Finland is mentioned as influencing current reality, but details of Finland are not presented. So they're talking about the Saima Park organization, and they're talking about the socialist movement, but they're not talking about what these are doing in Finland. So there's a kind of a loss of a cultural immediacy of Finland. Finland is mentioned as influencing current reality, but details of Finland are not presented. Cultural practices are, though. So how you engage in conversation with another person who visits your home is very much culturally determined in these texts. But specific things about what they're doing in Finland is not there. Finnishness permeates the text in terms of these organizations and in terms of the recognizable customs enacted therein. Now, by the way, in case people don't know, we have Laurie Anderson here for all of you who have not been introduced. So if she gets mortified, well, then we'll see how my analysis goes.
That's Casey.
Laurie has stuff to throw at you.
No, it's not wrong. Laurie Anderson and Shirley Spoonover's individual works are examples. And here now is where you get assertions of symbolic ethnicity. And the examples I chose can demonstrate symbolic ethnicity. I just don't think it should end there. I think that there's more to it than that. And in this one, that's what it looks like. I want you to be able to recognize it when you see it on the shelf. In Hunting Hemingway's Charles, Anderson's protagonist suffers trouble in love and seeks advice from his friend Pavel to help him sort out the problems he's having with the two women in his life. One is his live-in girlfriend, Cheryl, and the other a student in his class named Candy, who works at the local supermarket shelving groceries. Candy, as her name suggests, is a treat to look at, but she engages in duplicity that worries the protagonist, who cannot seem to extricate himself from her magnetic charms. Of his friend, the protagonist writes, "Pavel is my best friend. A backwoods Finn who grew up here in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, where we both teach. Pavel is my only real friend, the kind of guy that would help me out of any tight spot that wouldn't lead directly to prison. I came to Pavel because I didn't know what to do about Cheryl and the girl at the supermarket. I value his advice because he's the sort of guy who drives women crazy." This comes from his habit of dating two or three more or less at the same time. Of course, the protagonist seeks advice from exactly the kind of person that Candy seems to be. One dates more than one person at a time. One who mouths, "I love you," to one man with the moisture of the kiss from another still on her lips. Obviously, our hapless protagonist is in for a difficult time. This love triangle is a typical story in the third generation. With a mix of Finnish and American names, we see Pavel, we see Candy, we see Cheryl. The Finnish names to assert Finnishness that isn't specifically apparent in the text, and the American themes and names to locate its cultural location. So you won't necessarily immediately go, this is a Finnish American text, if you didn't see Pavel. I think. The other example,
And
excuse me, are you basing that just on that particular passage or the entire book?
Actually, no, you can distribute that across. I'm just taking this particular passage. And that's the troublesome thing about this symbolic ethnicity. If you look at third generation authors, you can see conspicuously Finnish seeming things. Mm-hmm. But you can also see these that are not blanketly Finnish seeming, that you can say this could be any love story anywhere, any love triangle, and you could change the name to Omar, and maybe it would be, you know, from a different culture entirely. So I think that saying symbolic ethnicity, but we'll see more here, okay, because something else is happening. We can see in some stories Finnishness, some stories not Finnishness, and necessarily if you're of the third generation, you can't replicate Finnishness in everything you write, and is the goal anyway to write with a Finn? It can't be, because if it would be, you would have to be in Finland. And what would happen to the other half, or depending on what your cultural experiences are, what your text might end up looking like. When I gave this presentation in Finland, everyone laughed when we got to this part, and so I don't know how this will go. Right. Winter Dream is here too, and I also took Mountain of Winter, and of Laurie's I took impressions of Arvo Lauvila and Hunting Hemingway's Trout. And I also took Children of the Color, and I can see it's upside down way over there. So there are three, if people just want to glance through at the end, that's perfectly fine. But they're all, I think, I don't know if you can buy Hunting Hemingway's Trout anymore, but you can buy the other two. Mythology. To frame a fantasy novel set in a several regions of Finland, including Louhi, Väinämöinen, Lemminkainen, Ilmarinen, and others. Now, the Finns are all good with this at this point. In the story, Hunover weds Louhi. The quintessential evil witch of the north is wedded to the hero. Modifying the ancient tale to suit third generation notions of things. In this move, she clearly engages, I call it filial pietistic move, overly liking way too much the Finnish culture, that she's going to make it what she wants it to be, to glorify at the expense of accuracy. She really is pleased to know, it appears, this mythology, but of course Louhi is a strong female character, albeit evil, and so let's just get rid of that part and let's use the hero Väinämöinen and put them together. And actually, if you read Winter Dream, aside from the cover's dead. It's actually a good book, if only they would have just picked different names. But it truly does draw on Gullivan mythology, except twisted.
Kind of an unlikely pair.
Really unlikely, yeah. And I kept reading as though, oh my God, Louhi's going to kill him or something, you know. But that
so chance is way out and turn her into something.
But somebody else was chanting too. It's pretty entertaining. It only costs like 99 cents at Abe Books Used. I don't think you can buy it new anymore. But the changes that Schoonover makes are kind of make this Louhi palatable for an American audience. That the evil witch is no longer evil. She's turned into something else. Now if we go back to the Candy story from Emerson's work, you can see that story particularly could be any ethnicity in terms of content and storyline. And this is where the assertion comes from certain quarters that symbolic ethnicity is like the fate of all third generation authors. Finnishness is implied in the use of names, and these are some names that are in the book. They're affixed to an American text. Finland is no longer specific and is not carried forth by organizations or groups. So in Anderson's work, and I think I can say this without getting the tomatoes thrown at me, is I don't see the Dramia Society, and I don't see the Finn Hall being enacted. This is at a different time, it's in a different setting. It's in a third generation mental context. It's not in that second generation supported by the cultural institution. So it's a different era. But pretty much, Finnishness isn't trying to accurately depict Finland. And from Schoonover, and this is, I think that she's more symbolically ethnic. Superficial characteristics of Finnishness are more important than accuracy of cultural representation. And poetic license allows. Because she's writing for an American audience, I am sure that not a soul who read that book said this can't happen. But it did happen. Okay, now, so I think that where my work is, and I'm really working at it and I'm really thinking about it, is what does this third generation look like, and then can I actually go here? Because I've run into a couple of stumbling blocks in the literary criticism community that suggest that maybe I'm going too far. I think that I can go here, but I could probably have articles written in response to my thing. She shouldn't have done that. And I want to say, well, okay, shouldn't, but I did. So the worldview is informed by first-hand experiences that reinforce and or contradict the received stories of the old country. Because if you travel to Finland these days, you have a first-hand experience. You can say, Finns are doing this. This is happening there. They don't use the coffee pot anymore. They have percolators. Or okay. Here we start, Kivisos both and starts to show up. In other words, previous theories of culture suggested that we're going to have this melting pot and everyone's going to blend in, and then we're going to occasionally like whip out our symbolic ethnicity through flags and coffee cups. But actually, they're suggesting that something else is happening, that you're getting, I'm Finnish and American. I am, so that my knowledge of the country of origin becomes real again through these communication and travel technologies that allow it to happen. So that you could actually take a course in the U.S. with your Finnish peers in Finland just by taking an online course, no problem. So your experience can be firsthand. And even Kuusisto is one that serves in as an example. I used to have, in the original work, I asserted that Sarah Arvio's work also could conform to this. And I think I was reaching too far and I had to take her name off, because I think that her transnationality isn't Finnish and American. Her transnationality is Finnish, Greek, Italian, and New York. So it's not a simple two places to identify with. It's much too complicated to fit in my simple theory and scheme of things. Fun of the Blind is here, and I didn't replicate it because I have enough trouble replicating without trying to replicate something that is really blurry in the first place. So if I would have done that, my eyes even would have had trouble. So I pictured this one, his latest work, instead. Then there's also one of poetry that he's done. Stephen Kuusisto was actually born with very, 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 very incredibly poor vision. And his parents, knowing the expectancy for success of a blind kid born in, I think he was born in the early 50s, you know, he'd be born working in a broom factory or something, that there wasn't a great bright future looking in front of him. His parents denied that he was blind.
And they said, well, no, he's just hard of hearing, because if you read his autobiographies, he could read like this one letter at a time, and putting it, holding it like that, and just say one letter. So Stephen Clifton worked to go through school reading with pop on the bottom glasses, one letter at a time. He went through all of K-12, earned a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, being not blind. Okay, so he received no help whatsoever that would have made his education easy. And it was somewhere around his, I think he's in his 30s when he actually does get a seeing eye dog, and accept the fact that he is actually blind, and we know what the ramifications are. But what he writes about is experiences of being blind. Though in recent emails with him, he says Helsinki is his first city, because it's the place where he came to awareness in a city, the first city he ever became aware of. His father was on a Fulbright scholarship at the University of Helsinki, and he spent some time there in his youth. I think his father was there twice during his growing up years, and then Kuzisto, after earning his master's degree, was there at the University of Helsinki, also on his own Fulbright fellowship, I think he was. He was studying Finnish poets, and you'll see a little bit of that here. But in any case, his experience with Finland is firsthand. It's different from what we might have had if we had done it, so we wouldn't say that seeing Helsinki Harbor was like seeing shards of discolored whatever, because he couldn't see the difference between the sky or the water or the land, because it was winter. In the transnational view, Finland becomes, again, specific. In his early work, Planet of the Blind, which has been translated into 5 or 7 different languages and sold throughout the globe, and it is actually sold in Finland in Finnish. Kuzisto introduces his readers to his Finnishness, that he spent time in Helsinki while his father was on a Fulbright scholarship 2 separate times, thus developing an understanding and an affinity for the home of his forefathers. In this knowledge, though, he does not do what overzealous third-generation authors do. After doing this, I went back and read some of my own creative nonfiction about going to Finland, and I thought, oh, I know, I'll eat myself. I should have been more like Kuzisto, because he does it so much better. He's not overly sentimental, and he's real. He doesn't romanticize Finland or Finnishness. In this text, he shows a variety of information about Finland and Finn's uniqueness. Of Helsinki, he says, it is one of the world's darkest cities. During his fellowship year, he planned to translate Finnish poetry into English, but he discovers that he can't see the dictionary. Traveling internationally too, you can't take your seeing my dog, is a little bit more difficult for him after he has a dog, because he becomes used to it and then he's without it. At the University of Helsinki, he got lost in the Tsarist building, lost in the language, lost in the opacity of retinopathy. So his Finland is colored by his views. When he meets a Finnish-American graduate student who was a Finnish, they strike up a natural affinity, the Finnish-American. What was their shared affection for Finnish literature and their mutual dismay at the cold and withdrawn city of Helsinki really is? In Helsinki, he's nearly killed by a trolley, but the bystanders pull him out of danger as the train passes. He says, this is my favorite line in the whole world. I sit on the pavement with my strewn bundles and taste the meat of my heart. Kuzisto does not glorify the bystanders, nor does he glorify the moments by making his faceless aids more heroic or authentic. than they really are. Afterwards, he goes to a bar in Capelno, a classic drunk poet. Not a classic drunk Finnish poet, a classic drunk poet. It didn't go over the overly done. There he gets drunk with Tano and recites poetry and song lyrics until the wee hours of the morning, drinking too much and laughing. Eventually, he comes to terms with his blindness, a condition that can be disputed. Unlike the issue of his heritage, which was never at issue in the text, clearly there seems to be an understanding of Puuso's part that Finnishness is something of which part of him has fashioned, of which part of him was fashioned, and other parts were fashioned from other experiences, including influences of American culture and the experiences of being blind. So when you read Puuso, you're always having this sense, there's this Finnish thing, there's this American thing, there's this blind thing happening, and sometimes they're all together, and sometimes they're not. The significance of transnational writing recreates the possibility of a Finland that is an actual place where things can really happen. Finland once again has specificity, both good and bad, and is no longer glorified. References retain actual significance that has to do, references have to do with Finnish Finland. Pardon my error there. Please don't take a picture of that slide. It's a place where people live, no longer the stuff of instant memory. It becomes real, while third generation may never visit their mythical home. The transnationals live in a world with multiple places to be at home. And I think that I come under fire for this here. The third generation doesn't make any bones about it. We're not Finnish. We don't speak Finnish. We're Americans of Finnish heritage. However we express that is one thing. But here with Puuso, I think that he's got a greater first-hand knowledge that can give him a greater claim to Finnishness that could ever happen with the third generation. And he might actually be a third generation. I didn't ask him. I get in trouble when I say he's transnational. And I don't think that I should, but I do.
So when you say mythical home, you're talking about Finland or the mythical home that he has created in his...
The third generation, I have a mythical home. It's outside Syrizat and Keuruu. And when I go there, these are little towns in Finland, I go there and I can have this imagined past where my great-grandmother was a girl and whole mythology. When I actually go there, I get lost. I can't find anything. I go to the church, I look at all the headstones, and I'm going like, whoa. And it's a kind of a frustrating experience. So my reality and my mythology don't match up. It's in the third generation brain that things are perceived as Finnish that might not really be. And the transnational, Puuso doesn't, I think, create a mythology about Finland. It is a real place, you know, and Helsinki is really cold, and you can, if you're not careful, get run over by a trolley.
Especially if you're blind.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. It's a kind of a different way of being and experiencing culture. Cool. And here, the first generation comparisons of Finnish and North American culture take prominent issues. For the first generation, the older parents, the things Finnish are much, much favored. And the second generation writers seek to explain their Finnishness in the North American context. So you get the sense of, we're Finnish, but we're American. And we're busy being successful as Americans. Third generation writers use Finnishism as ethnic decoration. This is very much on the Schoonover case and mainstream North American text, on mainstream North American text. Finnishness is venerated, but not specific. So it doesn't exist as a real thing. And transnational Finland is not perfect, but it reacquires actual detail and specificity.
Cool.
course.